KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Indeed, the challenge of the Secretary of Defense is to remove partisan politics from the military. You propose to inject it.
Democrats grill Trump's nominee to lead the Pentagon as Senate hearings for Trump's cabinet picks get underway.
For Tuesday, January 14th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Despite progress attacking fires here in Los Angeles County, local officials are calling for residents to stay vigilant.
I don't want people to start thinking everything's okay now. Everything's not okay yet. The wind's blowing, and it's going to continue to blow.
Also, are wartime sanctions against Russia working?
I think that the sanctions that have been placed on Russia have had effects. I don't think that they've necessarily achieved the goals.
And Duke Divinity School professor Kate Bowler on trying to be less efficient in her life.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In Los Angeles, the winds are picking up, raising fears that flying embers could spark more fires as the powerful Santa Ana winds are expected through tomorrow. More than 40,000 acres have burned, more than 100,000 people have been displaced, and at least 24 are dead. Now the struggle to find a place to stay, even though many don't know if their homes are still standing. Hotels and rentals outside the fire zone are in short supply, but as NPR's Adrian Florido reports, there is help available.
Those with insurance are beginning to file claims. FEMA also opened two disaster recovery centers today where people can seek financial and housing help. A lot of folks are leaning on friends and family. Some have opened GoFundMe campaigns, and there has been a huge outpouring of donations from across LA and beyond.
NPR's Adrian Florido reporting. Pete Hegseth, the Army National Guard veteran and former Fox News host, faced intense criticism from Democrats during his hearing today before the Senate Armed Services Committee to serve as President-elect Donald Trump's defense secretary. As NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports, Hegseth will likely be confirmed if Republican senators remain united behind him.
Senate Democrats repeatedly chastised the nominee for not meeting with them prior to the hearing, as is customary. They also voiced concerns about allegations of alcohol abuse, financial mismanagement of organizations he was in charge of, and sexual assault. Hegseth said if confirmed, he would not drink, and said the allegations against him were part of a smear campaign orchestrated in the media. An attorney for the nominee has said that Hegseth paid a woman who accused him of assault in 2017 in order to prevent her from bringing forth a lawsuit that would be damaging to his career. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
A group of students and professors is challenging an Alabama law that restricts diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports a federal lawsuit claims the law stifles free speech and is discriminatory.
Professors and students from the University of Alabama and the NAACP are suing the school's Board of Trustees and Governor Kay Ivey for enforcing the anti-DEI law that took effect in October. It prohibits public schools and colleges from DEI activities and also bans coursework that promotes divisive concepts. The lawsuit argues the law discriminates against racial minorities and violates the First Amendment by censoring dissenting viewpoints. One professor says she was threatened with termination for teaching a class on anti-oppression and social justice. Alabama Governor Ivey says she stands behind the law's intent. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are trading higher at this hour. Dow futures up about 0.1%. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Biden administration has removed Cuba from a list of state sponsors of terrorism. Officials say this is one of three steps to ease sanctions on Cuba in a movement to help the Catholic Church win the release of a significant number of political prisoners. The administration says that it expects Cuba to act quickly. This just days before Biden leaves office. But the decisions on sanctions could be reversed once Donald Trump takes office. He reinstated the terrorism designation at the end of his first term in office. And Secretary of State designate Marco Rubio, whose family left Cuba, has long supported sanctions on the island nation. What's happening with prices on our store shelves? Inflation has cooled for about 2 years, but it doesn't always feel that way at the checkout. NPR's Alina Selyuk has been tracking prices at a suburban Savannah Walmart for years and has more.
NPR has been recording prices of dozens of items in virtually every aisle of this Walmart. Snacks, shampoo, t-shirts, dog food. And the takeaway really differs depending on the long view versus the short view. Over the course of a year, over 2024, on average, prices on this list rose 0.7%. Exactly half of the items did not change in price at all. About a fifth of them actually got cheaper. But for shoppers remembering pre-pandemic prices, the five-year view is much more painful. Compared to 2019, prices on NPR's list on average rose 25%, and a small handful of items got cheaper. All the details are on npr.org/shoppingcart. Alina Seluch, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington, where President-elect Donald Trump's nominee to lead the Pentagon appeared on Capitol Hill today. Pete Hegseth's nomination has been plagued by controversy. Today, he insisted he is a veteran who's up for the job.
That it's time to give someone with dust on his boots the helm. A change agent.
If confirmed, the former Fox News host would be the least experienced secretary in the history of the Defense Department. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh and Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman are with me now to discuss it all. And Deirdre Walsh, I'm going to start with you. You were in the room. What was the tone of the hearing and what specific issues was Hegseth pressed on?
This was a really partisan confirmation hearing. That's really a departure from previous ones for nominees to lead the Pentagon. Democrats were pretty aggressive in their questioning of Hegseth, but Hegseth himself was combative at times, talking over Democratic senators during many of the exchanges. The hearing room was packed. This was a larger room than the traditional armed services hearing room to accommodate the interest. And Hegseth had a lot of supporters there who occasionally applauded during his responses. Democrats came into this hearing with serious concerns about Hegseth's qualifications. And down the line, they pressed him over and over again on his ability to lead this department that has 3 million plus employees. They also pressed him on allegations of sexual misconduct, drinking on the job, fiscal mismanagement at veterans organizations. Hegseth had only met with the top Democrat on the panel before the hearing, Jack Reed, and Reed raised concerns about Hegseth possibly injecting politics into the military and what that would mean for service members.
And I would ask you to explain why service members and civilians who do not share your political opinions can trust that they will not be targeted during your tenure.
One issue that came up repeatedly during the hearing from both Republicans and Democrats was Hegseth's previous comments opposing women serving in ground combat roles.
Yeah, I want to stay on that point for a second and bring you in, Tom Bowman, because this has been very contentious, Hegseth's past comments about women in combat roles.
Right. Yeah, right. And he said in November in the Sean Ryan podcast that, quote, women should not be in ground combat. Today, he said that women should be allowed in those jobs, such as infantry, armor, or artillery, as long as they meet the same standards as men. He said, anecdotally, he's hearing standards have been lowered. Military officials deny that to me. And today, under intense questioning, he really flipped on the issue. Let's listen.
Women in our military, as I have said publicly, have and continue to make amazing contributions across all aspects of our battlefield.
And also, you know, Democrats focused on his lack of experience. You know, he ran two small veterans organizations, groups, but he'll be running the Pentagon again with 3 million employees.
Yeah, this was, I opened this conversation by saying he would be the least experienced secretary in the history of that department. Did he address questions about his lack of experience?
Mary Louise, he really didn't. He kept calling himself a disruptor, a change agent, which is what President Trump wants. He clearly has less experience than any defense secretary since the job was created in 1947. Even going back to George Washington, his first secretary of war, he has less experience. In all cases, those people came from high positions in politics, industry, or the military, and his time running two veterans groups raised questions about financial mismanagement as well. Now, as far as the personal issues, he says questions about excessive drinking, sexual assault, or financial mismanagement, they're all part of a smear campaign, false allegations, or just disgruntled employees.
Okay, so those are a lot of the questions that were asked and answered about his past record. Deirdre, what did he say looking forward? Like, what does he actually want to do if he's confirmed? Did he give specifics on what he would like to change?
He didn't, and he really wouldn't engage when he was pressed by some of these policy questions, continuing existing policies at the Pentagon or what he means about ones going forward. He didn't answer about the war in Ukraine. At times he would sort of punt and say, you know, he would support President Trump's proclamations on these issues. He talked about instituting a war ethos at the Pentagon, but he didn't elaborate on what that meant. When he talked about women serving in combat roles, mm-hmm. a position he changed, mm-hmm. he did essentially sort of open the door because he talked about reviewing standards. He said there needed to be high standards, possibly leaving the door open to maybe revising them. One issue he did talk about in more detail was his belief that diversity, equity, inclusion policies at the Pentagon should be essentially ripped out.
Huh. One issue he was known for talking about back in his Fox News days, Tom, was championing cases of some service members charged with war crimes. Did we learn any more about that?
You know, we really didn't. Hegseth has supported several service members who were charged with war crimes. He was asked about that, and he said warfighters have had their hands tied behind their back. Basically, there are too many military lawyers, too many international laws or rules like the Geneva Conventions. It was pointed out to Hegseth that allegations of war crimes came from his comrades and those accused and not from lawyers. Hegseth, he also was asked about Donald Trump's suggestion in his first administration that the military should shoot protesters in the legs. Defense Secretary Mark Esper at the time and others talked Trump out of it. Would Hegseth follow such an order, he was asked? He wouldn't answer.
That is NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman and congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
The Biden administration announced today that it will be removing Cuba from its state sponsors of terrorism list. The action comes a day before Senator Marco Rubio's scheduled nomination hearing for Secretary of State. Rubio is a Miami native and Cuban American, and he has worked in the past to prevent Biden from removing Cuba from that list. Tristan Wood from WFSU reports on how Rubio's roots could influence his approach if he is confirmed to be the nation's top diplomat.
In 2022, Hialeah Mayor Esteban Bovo, speaking at Rubio's election night party, heaped heavy praise on the senator after he won re-election to a third term.
He fell in for a long time. He has made a difference, not just in Washington, but he did it when he was in Tallahassee. He has been a strong voice for those that can speak, especially for those in Cuba that seek freedom.
The city of Hialeah has the highest percentage of residents of Cuban descent compared to any other U.S. city. And Rubio got his political start representing a portion of this city back in 2000 in Florida's House of Representatives. Cuban Americans are also a big reason why Miami-Dade County turned red during the last presidential election. Last November, President-elect Donald Trump won 55% of the vote in Miami-Dade. When he first ran for president in 2016, he got 33%.
There are two things that made modern Miami. They are air conditioning, and Fidel Castro.
That's Sean Foreman, political science professor at Barry University in Miami. He says the transformation of Miami's politics is the result of sustained outreach from Republicans. They've also tried to appeal to Cuban and Venezuelan Americans with anti-Castro and anti-communist messaging. Rubio has also embraced those political tactics. Here he is on the Senate floor denouncing Cuba's response to anti-government protests in 2021.
We should be clear in our language. We don't just condemn this tyranny, we condemn this communist, this Marxist, this socialist tyranny. Call it for what it is.
If confirmed as the first Cuban-American Secretary of State, Foreman thinks Rubio will sharpen his attacks.
Marco Rubio's political career, as well as his life as a Cuban-American, has been around this whole issue of maintaining a hard line against Cuba, but also against Venezuela and other Central American countries that may elect a left-leaning socialist type.
Rubio has also railed against China, so much so he was banned in 2020 from visiting the country. He was one of the first lawmakers that called for the banning of TikTok in 2019 out of concerns it would provide data to the Chinese Communist Party. Through further speeches on the Senate floor, like here in 2023, he continued to link his concerns over the social media app back to China's government.
The number one victims of the Chinese Communist Party are the Chinese people. But their government is very simple, guys. They want to be the world's most powerful country, and they want to do it at our expense.
Nikki Fried, chair of the Florida Democratic Party, says while it's important to take a stand against communism, Rubio also often messages on those issues for political gain.
You have a politician like Marco Rubio, who then knows the sensitivity associated with words like communism and socialism, and you then weaponize those words for your own political advantage here in the United States, shame on you.
Last May, Trump was found guilty of 34 felonies in his hush money trial. Rubio compared that verdict to what people say they've experienced under the Cuban government. Here he is on Fox News' special report with Brett Baer.
They've been doing this against Trump for 7-8 years. The shock is that this could happen in America. I grew up listening to people tell me about show trials and things that happen in Cuba, that this is a show trial.
Rubio's entire political career has been spent representing the state of Florida. But if nominated to be Secretary of State, his personal priorities will have to take a back seat to what his boss, Donald Trump, wants. For NPR News, I'm Tristan Wood from Tallahassee.
This morning, the most downloaded free app in Apple's App Store was a Chinese-owned social media site.
But it's not TikTok. It's actually called Xiaohongshu, which is known here in the U.S. as Red Note. It's one of China's biggest social media platforms.
That's right. American users are flocking to the site looking for a TikTok alternative because of the potential ban looming. And the irony that they are moving to another Chinese-run app is not lost on them. Users like the Sleepy DM say that's part of the appeal.
Did the U.S. government forget our founding principles? We are a nation built on spite.
Most of the app is in Chinese. So, user Chris Du is trying to learn Mandarin.
Why does it literally feel like the first day of school? Like we're the new kids and we don't know where anything is. Like, what's cool here?
User Britton Ray may have first day jitters, but many Chinese users on Red Note, like Wendy Simpson, are standing by.
Hello, TikTok refugees. I'm here to help you better understand this platform.
Whether TikTok does get banned, or whether Red Note does, for that matter, content creators like Kalia Denise will find a place to grow their platforms. But she's got one big question.
How do we get paid on that app, though?
Great question, Kalia. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Picture a cardboard box packed with envelopes, swabs, a comb, nail clippers, you know, stuff you could find in almost any drugstore. Well, this box, as mundane as it sounds, represented a revolution in law enforcement. It was the rape kit, and it is one of the most important inventions in the history of investigating and prosecuting sexual assaults. And yet, the visionary behind the rape kit system has largely been forgotten by history. One reporter was determined to track down Marty Goddard, the woman who made it her life's mission to design and push the rape kit out into the world before she seemed to vanish from the world without a trace. Pagan Kennedy details the story in her new book, The Secret History of the Rape Kit. She joins us now. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. So tell me what initially made you want to delve into the origins of the rape kit, because it presented several mysteries to you at once, right?
Yes. This started for me in 2018. The rape kit was very much in the news then because of the backlog. There were almost 500,000 kits that had not been processed by police departments, and this had become a big scandal. But as soon as I was thinking about it, it just seemed so amazing to me that this national system existed that could provide evidence of a sexual assault or be used to also prove that a man falsely accused of sexual assault was innocent. It just seemed like such an amazing thing, given that so often survivors just aren't believed. There was this very disorganized system for collecting evidence after a sexual assault victim came into the hospital. But because nobody was talking to each other and it was all very disorganized, often the evidence would just be thrown out. And often the survivor would be treated with no respect at all.
And can you talk more about that culture? Because Marty Goddard, I mean, she's working during the 1970s on this mission. Can you just describe how law enforcement generally approached sexual assault investigations and prosecutions back then? How much was stacked against the accuser?
First of all, marital rape was legal at that time. I found this mind-blowing article called Little Ladies of the Night in the New York Times, which talked about the problem of 13-year-old girls who were turning tricks in Midtown Manhattan. And the whole problem was blamed on these children. You know, the whole way that people conceived of child abuse was thought to be very rare, and yet it was just going on in plain sight, as was sexual assault. And so often when a survivor came to the police or an accuser, you know, first of all, it was completely up to the police detective to decide how he felt about her. I mean, that was actually written into the handbooks back then. The handbooks would say many, many of the people who accuse sexual assault are liars, and so you don't have to listen to them. And so, I mean, I could go on and on. There's just so many things that make your blood boil. I think Marty Goddard was fighting for the idea that sexual assault could be proven with evidence.
Exactly. She asks a very simple question, right? Like, and that question is, what if sexual assault could be investigated and prosecuted like other crimes such as murder or robbery, where there was a way, in many cases, to prove with physical evidence that the crime had happened? Can you explain how revolutionary it was to ask that question at the time?
Absolutely, because, again, the survivor would come in, she would be treated with utter disrespect. Like, the police might bring her into the hospital and just yell out, "We have a rape here." So there was, you know, so much almost harassment of the survivors. But then also there was the idea that every assault was just a he said, she said, and you would never, ever be able to prove it. And the fact that nobody was trying to really collect the evidence, or that evidence was so often thrown out, of course, just reinforce that idea. So Marty Goddard really fought for the idea that, look, we have to create a system here. We have to train the nurses, train the crime lab, build this into every hospital. You know, she did so much. She raised the money to create this citywide and then statewide rape kit system. There was all this training. There was a system she put in place inside the kits so that everybody who dealt with it was on the same page and was using the same techniques and, you know, really communicating with each other.
And by the mid-1980s, how do you see the rape kit system change?
Yes. Yeah, so it's important to say that when all of this was happening in Chicago in the 1970s, DNA fingerprinting or identification still hadn't been invented yet. Physical evidence was still, of course, very important, but what you were able to tell from like a blood sample was rather limited.
Right.
But then DNA fingerprinted is invented in the mid-1980s and starts to filter out into forensics. And now you've already got this nationwide system of these kits full of biological evidence. Mm-hmm. So now they're just a million times more powerful because you can now identify the exact perpetrator. And that really changes what you can do with this kit. You can really say, you know, with pretty good certainty, this person was the person whose blood or semen was collected. Or you could say this person is innocent.
Was not.
Yes.
Right. And you could exonerate people.
Yes. And this, the exonerations are just as important as the convictions.
Absolutely. When you consider how many sexual assaults still go unreported today, how much do you think has really changed in terms of how society treats survivors of rape compared to 50 years ago when Marty Goddard was on this crusade?
I don't think I knew sexual assault was illegal until I was in college in the 1980s. Wow. It was always treated as just something that happened. Mm-hmm. And if you put yourself in the way, if you were in the parking lot or anywhere, honestly, would be considered your fault. Mm-hmm. You got what you deserved, sort of. So I think, you know, for me, learning that the rape kit existed as a young woman and that there were these laws and exactly what the laws were, it was so amazing because at least in theory, the government and the norms of society were that this was wrong. Marty Goddard and the other anti-rape activists of the time created a new set of norms. They created the idea that every survivor had the right to file evidence and to be treated with respect and to have that evidence taken seriously and tested. And even though we've always fallen short on that goal, the fact that it is a norm is really important. So many people are aware that the kit exists, but they don't know what it looks like. They don't know how it works. There's a kind of invisibility to it. And I feel like part of my mission is to make it visible because I think if it remains invisible, if people don't understand what it is exactly and how it works.
And how extraordinary it was that it even came to be.
Exactly. I think then it makes it easier to take it away.
Pagan Kennedy's new book is called The Secret History of the Rape Kit, a true crime story. Thank you so much, Pagan, for teaching us about Marty Goddard and what she did for this world. And thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Some of President-elect Trump's cabinet choices face stiff opposition. Marco Rubio is a little different, a veteran senator, former presidential candidate, former critic of President-elect Trump, who came to agree with many of his foreign policy views. Rubio's path toward the State Department on the next morning edition from NPR News.
All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Drug companies often raise prices in January.
This year, they are right on track, jacking prices of hundreds of brand name drugs.
The list prices for drugs create great signals for what might be happening in the marketplace and what incentives might be driving certain behaviors.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. More than 50 Palestinians were killed by Israeli strikes in Gaza within the last day, and five Israeli soldiers have been killed in the fighting. That's according to the military. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports it's one of the deadlier days for both sides in recent weeks.
The casualties occurred from strikes throughout Gaza, particularly in Gaza City in the north, where heavy fighting was reported by the Israeli military. Gaza civil defense spokesman Mahmoud Basil warned residents there not to walk in the streets or gather in groups for their safety. Today is another bloody day, he said, saying it will continue until a ceasefire is reached. The north was also where all five Israeli soldiers were killed. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas are, quote, at the brink of a full and final agreement. He said they are waiting on Hamas to accept. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Forecasters say winds are picking up strength in Southern California that could create conditions for new wildfires. Los Angeles County Fire Chief Anthony Maroney.
Please be assured that the Los Angeles County region is prepared. The anticipated winds, combined with low humidities and low fuel moistures, will keep the fire threat in the LA region critical.
Emergency crews have been working around the clock to contain the massive wildfires that have been raging across Los Angeles County for more than a week. The National Weather Service has issued a red flag warning for dangerous weather that could lead to explosive fire growth. Stocks closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow was up 221 points. The Nasdaq fell 43. This is NPR News in Washington. About 100,000 music scores, none original by the 20th century composer Arnold Schoenberg, have been destroyed in the Palisades Fire in L.A. County. Jeff London reports they were stored in a building behind the home of the composer's son Larry, which was also destroyed.
The Austrian-born composer settled in Southern California in the 1930s after fleeing the Nazis, where he continued to write his groundbreaking atonal music. In 1965, Arnold Schoenberg's heirs created Belmont Music, which published the composer's scores and licensed performances of his work. But that material, along with irreplaceable memorabilia, was destroyed in the fire. No original scores were lost there in Vienna, but the loss of performance materials could affect many planned concerts of Schoenberg's work. Belmont Music plans to create digital versions of the material. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
Social media company Meta has announced layoffs. In a memo posted on the company's internal website, CEO Mark Zuckerberg says the move is aimed at reducing 5% of the company's lowest performing employees. Workers affected by the layoffs will be notified by February 10th. Meta employs more than 72,000 people. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Drug companies typically raise the prices of name brand drugs in early January. Sure enough, this month, sticker prices of hundreds of medicines went up. But in our complicated health system, what does that mean for consumers? NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin is here. Hi there, Sydney.
Hi.
What prices went up this year?
Yeah, so prices went up for 575 name brand drugs, and that's just in the first 2 days of the year. Those included drugs for diabetes, HIV, cancer, rare diseases, and more. There are some familiar names, Ozempic for type 2 diabetes and Paxlovid to treat COVID. Here's Antonio Chacha of the drug research price research firm 46 Brooklyn, which did the analysis and shared it with NPR.
The list prices for drugs create great signals for what might be happening in the marketplace and what incentives might be driving certain behaviors, not just by drug companies, but every layer of the drug supply chain.
So the list prices are the starting point, kind of like the sticker price for a new car. There are discounts and different kinds of rebates that affect what actually gets paid, kind of like car maker incentives. NPR reached out to the companies that make Ozempic and Paxlovid to ask them why they raise these prices, about 3% each, according to 46 Brooklyn. Neither detailed the specifics behind these particular price increases, but Novo Nordisk said it raised some drug prices because of changes in the healthcare system and other factors like inflation. Pfizer said modest price increases for its products help it discover and develop new medicines and address other increasing business costs.
And then what about other drugs? Did other drug prices go up a lot?
So according to 46 Brooklyn, the median price increase was 4%, which if it holds the rest of the year would make it the lowest in more than a decade. But many of this year's increases are still above inflation, which is 2.7%. And that means penalties in Medicaid and other programs kick in, but the companies are raising prices above inflation anyway.
So higher drug prices, does that add up to ultimately consumers are going to have to spend more to get the drugs they need in 2025?
Yeah, so if the drug that you need isn't covered by insurance, then yes, you'll be paying more. If it is covered, then you're likely not paying the full sticker price, but you might have a copay at the pharmacy counter or coinsurance that's often a percentage of the sticker price. So a higher price could mean it costs you more too.
Right.
But there's another possibility that's kind of counterintuitive. Sometimes a higher price means there's more room for the drug maker to negotiate a big discount or rebate with the health plans. And that incentive might put the drug in a better position on a formulary. That's the menu of drugs a health plan will pay for. It has tiers. Drugs on the best tiers often get the lowest copays. Here's Amit Serpotwari of Harvard Medical School.
So an increase in a list price may paradoxically result in better access on the formulary because there is a large rebate tied to it.
So that means that even if the sticker price went up, a consumer could have a lower copay.
Okay, it's like way more confusing than shopping for a new car. Is there any just flat out good news? Like, did any prices actually go down?
So yes, a few did. A notable decrease was for Januvia, a type 2 diabetes drug. It went down by 42%, which Chacha and Serpotwari both told me they found puzzling. Januvia is one of the 10 drugs whose price was negotiated in Medicare for the first time ever under the Biden administration as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act. Merck says it didn't cut the price because of the negotiation.
And NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin. Thank you, Sydney.
Thank you.
Firefighters in Los Angeles continue to battle the devastating fires that have charred more than 37,000 acres and left at least 24 people dead. Fire crews are on high alert today as the Weather Service has issued a rare warning for strong dry winds and severely dry conditions through tomorrow. L.A. County Sheriff Robert Luna said today that despite progress attacking fires in some areas, people need to be vigilant.
I don't want people to start thinking everything's okay now. Everything's not okay yet. We'll get there. We'll get there together. But again, the wind's blowing and it's going to continue to blow.
The fires have destroyed the homes of thousands of people, but the blazes have also hurt many in the city's large immigrant workforce, people whose livelihoods depend on those homes that are now damaged or gone. Saul Gonzalez of member station KQED has this story.
On the edge of LA's Pacific Palisades neighborhood, where hundreds of properties have been destroyed or damaged in the fires, people gather daily at police checkpoints that bar entry. Most who come to the checkpoints are residents of the wealthy LA enclave, desperate to see the condition of their homes. But others are people who work in those homes, like Claribel Linares.
So what are you doing here, Claribel?
I just work around here. I just manage a big house on the hill. So I just came here to see if they let me in so I can check on the house because the owner are not here, so they are in Hawaii right now.
Linares is part of a large community of household workers in Pacific Palisades, and she now fears for all of their futures.
A lot of people are working in here, then people that right now I think they are going to be out of job because of this disaster. People who cleans pool, gardeners, people who cleans, nannies, dog walkers, a lot of people.
According to a 2020 UCLA study, there are some 350,000 domestic workers in California, with more than a third of them in the greater LA area. Most are immigrant women of color, and many don't have legal status in the U.S.
They are extremely vulnerable.
Megan Ortiz is the director of ADEPSCA, a Los Angeles group that advocates for domestic workers. She says the destruction of so many LA homes in the fires is financially devastating to this workforce.
These are workers who don't get paid on a weekly, biweekly basis. These are workers who literally get paid day by day and losing one day, 2 days, 3 days. How many days are we since the fire? They're really desperate and concerned about being able to feed their families.
The mostly male immigrant workforce who work as day laborers in the LA area are also feeling the job effects of the fires. That includes the men who gather every morning looking for employment outside of the Home Depot that's closest to the Eaton Fire, which also destroyed several hundred homes. Jose, an immigrant from Mexico, doesn't want his last name used because he's without legal status. He says all the fires have affected day laborers in the area, and a lot of people are now without work. Victor, another day laborer outside the Home Depot, works with crews putting up home fencing and retaining walls. He says all those jobs have now vanished, and he can't send money back to his family in Mexico because there's no work. Looking ahead, some in the Los Angeles area already talk about a possible job boom since immigrants will be needed to clean up debris from torched properties and start rebuilding. But labor advocate Megan Ortiz worries such workers could be exploited and may not be provided with gear to protect them from potential toxins in the burned out homes.
We're also talking about workers who are scared to complain about bad workplace conditions, are willing to face health and safety hazards like breathing in ash while not being given the proper PPE because they need to eat.
Ortiz hopes that as LA eventually looks toward fire recovery, city, state, and federal officials will help support immigrant domestic workers and day laborers affected by the fires. For NPR News, I'm Saul Gonzalez in Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. An operation is underway to rescue hundreds of illegal miners trapped in an abandoned gold mine shaft in South Africa. This started off as a standoff between South African police and illegal miners. Months later, with many miners dead of starvation, it has turned into a desperate rescue mission. Kate Bartlett reports from the mining town of Stilfontein. And a warning, her story mentions cannibalism and details of starvation.
People here are angry. Their small town of Stilfontein in Northwest Province, South Africa, has become the site of a human tragedy that could have been prevented. At the edge of the abandoned gold mine, a cage is slowly being lowered down to rescue scores of illegal miners, known here as Zamazamas, who have been languishing underground for months.
We are not going to celebrate and give accolades to the government and say, finally, they came. The only thing that we are appreciating is the fact that at least the families will be given an opportunity to bury their loved ones.
Muskizi Jam is a civil society leader who's been urging the government to help their illegal miners for months now. But the government repeatedly refused, saying the Zamazamas were dangerous criminals who needed to be smoked out. Eventually, after a court order, a rescue operation began this week. Now they are bringing up the survivors and the bodies, of which there were over 50 on Tuesday alone.
It's not a good moment at all. He's been underground since July last year.
Zinzi Tom has been waiting at the rescue site to see if her brother will be brought up alive.
One thing that I told myself and pray to God to give me strength, I have to make sure that he's okay and pray to God.
South Africa was once the world's biggest gold producer, but many mines have been shut down and abandoned. The road to Stilfontein, a small town over 100 miles southwest of Johannesburg, is dotted with massive mine dumps, rising out of the countryside like something from a sci-fi film. Local Samuel Sehebeng is having a drink at the nearby township tavern. He was a casualty of mine layoffs.
I used to work in the mining industry. I lost my job through retrenchment. It was in 2017. Thereafter, I've been unemployed since then.
Zamazama is Zulu for one who takes a chance. And take a chance, they certainly do. They eke out a living, spending weeks deep underground in dangerous conditions searching for gold. Many are desperately impoverished people toiling for heavily armed criminal syndicates. They are from South Africa, as well as neighboring countries like Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Lesotho. As the day wore on, a group of Zamazamas were brought up to the surface. One collapses, unable to walk. They look like skeletons, dust-covered and blinking at the harsh sunlight, and are led away to waiting ambulances.
People are dying here. Please help. Please, please, please.
Earlier in the week, one of the groups released this camera footage showing multiple corpses down below, emaciated miners, and a plaintive plea for help from one unknown miner. Some have become so desperate, they have resorted to the unthinkable, according to civil society leader Muskizi Jam.
The situation down there is bad to an extent that they have started eating human flesh.
For now, rescue workers can only hope to recover as many alive as possible. But with the promise of gold, it's unlikely South Africa's Zamazamas will stop risking their lives underground anytime soon. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Stilfontein, South Africa.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. For almost 3 years, the U.S. and its allies have slapped roughly 5,000 sanctions and export controls on Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. This has targeted everything from energy to oligarchs to access to global trade. But the war continues. NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam looks at how effective the sanctions have been.
Late last week, the Biden administration announced a new and expansive round of sanctions on Russia. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said they were aimed at Russia's largest sources of revenue.
These sanctions target both Russian oil and LNG, and we expect our actions to cost Russia upwards of billions of dollars per month.
This latest round of sanctions in the final days of the Biden administration included two major Russian oil producers, liquefied natural gas projects, oil traders and technicians, and nearly 200 tankers. Like the many other rounds of sanctions over the past 3 years, they're meant to make it difficult for Moscow to finance the war in Ukraine.
I think that the sanctions that have been placed on Russia have had an effect. I don't think that they've necessarily achieved the goals of the sanctions.
Kimberly Donovan is director of the Economic Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council, which charts the efficacy of sanctions. She says sanctions have not brought the Kremlin to its knees.
They were able to develop a lot of workarounds to evade those sanctions. So they've had, you know, some time to really hone their kind of money laundering and sanctions evasion techniques.
Some neighboring countries have allowed Western technology and consumer goods to cross their borders into Russia. And the Kremlin has found voracious new markets for their oil, China and India, that paid rock-bottom prices for crude. The Kremlin also built up a so-called shadow fleet, old tankers around the world used to smuggle sanctioned oil. Eric Bruckhausen is head of tanker research at Poten & Partners, an international shipbroker and energy consultant.
The fleet has grown quickly from to maybe 600, between 600 and 1,000 now. And that has allowed Russia to maintain their exports at pretty much the pre-invasion levels.
Bruckhausen says this latest round of sanctions significantly strengthens penalties, effectively barring any individual or company from the U.S. financial system if it deals with about 200 newly sanctioned shadow fleet vessels.
What will happen now is all these sanctioned ships will not be allowed to go into certain ports. And it's not just China. I think India has also indicated that none of the ships that are on the sanction list will ultimately be able to go to India either.
Sergey Guriev, professor of economics and dean at the London Business School, says efforts by the U.S. and its allies have hit Russia in other ways. It's lost hundreds of billions of dollars in foreign currency reserves. Interest rates are running at about 20%, and major energy projects in the Arctic have stalled.
You see cracks in the sense that Putin now has to increase taxes because he's running low on financial resources. He actually canceled subsidies for mortgages, so he feels financial constraints.
Still, Gurdjieff says Putin could continue waging war. President-elect Trump says he wants to use sanctions as little as possible. However, Gurdjieff says Trump could use them as an incentive.
The carrot is, if you negotiate, we'll remove certain sanctions. The stick is, if you don't negotiate, we'll provide Ukraine with a lot more weapons.
Gurdjieff says it's unclear whether sanctions will ever force Putin to end the war, but adds, imagine what would have happened if no sanctions were in place. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Every week, a well-known guest draws a card from the wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. Duke Divinity School professor Kate Bowler was 35 years old when she was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. She wrote a best-selling memoir about that experience titled Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. She looks at the way people try to put a positive spin on bad things, even when there is not a silver lining to be found. Kate Bowler now hosts a podcast called Everything Happens. She talked to Wildcard host Rachel Martin.
What do you wish you could let go of?
I think it's something I write about all the time because I'm always really struggling with it, is that cultural insistence that we always have to be getting better. I'd love to give up the idea that in every area of my life, I'm supposed to, you know, come the new year, always have this New Year's moment. But I always end up looking at my life like it's some kind of quadrant with, you know, progress and mostly dramatic and sudden failures. And so I am always accidentally measuring. And I don't think that's, I think we're supposed to get worse at some things because we're not paying any attention to it. And we found something better to focus on. I wish for everyone that they didn't wake up and think about how much they weigh in the morning. I mean, just what a waste of time.
Yeah.
Waste of a good woman over here. It's just caring.
Yeah. So now I go one step deeper and ask you to share, if you would be willing to, what's a thing that you find yourself measuring yourself with or against that you want to release?
There's a way of measuring a day that I've been trying desperately to stop doing, and I can't seem to do it. And it's, I think it was probably the first time I really started thinking about efficiency and treating my life like a Ford Motor Company. But when I wake up in the day, I know exactly how many hours it takes me to do some of the most important things that I want to do. Like, I know exactly how long writing should take me for a certain number of words. And that served me really well when I had cancer. I mean, I was like, okay, this is the amount of time I have. This is the amount of energy I have. Like, how do I spend my life? But the metaphor of spending is really corrosive. Yeah. So then I find it much more difficult to actually focus on some of the really lovely things that I actually need in my life that are not very measurable. Like, I don't read not useful things very often because I'm always trying to put in the time it takes to make the thing I want to make. Mm-hmm. And so the only way I think a lot of growth in that area is friends. I can spend I will waste my life with my friends all day long. But when it comes to me, I would love to have more just like uncounted, completely wasted, doesn't matter time.
Yeah.
And I'm so judgy with myself. I have only hopeful feelings that other people will waste their time, but I find it almost impossible for me to waste my time. And I think just I got worse like this when I got sick, and now I'm an efficiency monster and I can't undo it.
You can hear more of that conversation with Kate Bowler on the Wildcard podcast.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business. With an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com. From Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.